The hour of 1 o'clock having arrived, I call the Conference Committee on House File 2431 to order. Today on our agenda will be a discussion of campus sexual misconduct provisions. Members, just some background. We discussed the policy provisions on Friday, but we skipped the discussion on campus sexual misconduct provisions found on the R34 through R39 in the side-by-sides. We did this, and we're bringing this forward today because we want to make sure that OHE had the right staff here to help guide that discussion. And with us today is Missy Watchke from the Office of Higher Education to speak to the differences in the provisions and share OHE's perspective. Welcome to our conference committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Walgamut and chairs and committee members, for the record, my name is Melissa Watchke. I'm the Sexual Violence Prevention Response Program at the Office of Higher Education. I, as the Title IX Training Administrator, I serve 77 institutions across the state of Minnesota in their providing technical assistance and training opportunities on Title IX and sexual misconduct policy provisions. So thank you very much.
All right, members, any questions for our testifier? All right, thank you for your testimony. Seth? Okay, would you?
Please speak to the differences.
On page R34, on the Senate side, 31.5, lines 32.1, we add a definition of retaliation. On R36, the differences, just generally speaking, and I'm happy to answer any questions, it goes into the actual sexual misconduct grievance procedures. The Senate side includes most of the feedback that I received from many or institutions across the state, from very small private institutions, career schools, to the University of Minnesota. So the Senate side is a more robust version. The House side was the original draft of what we were discussing within the House. It is not as robust. Starting on line on page R36, 32.19, one of the recommendations was to kind of to separate what types of resolution processes that a grievance process would that institutions follow, and that would include a range from alternative resolution to a formal grievance procedure and supportive measures. Line 33.1, one feedback on the Senate side, and 27.14. 27.18. There were a number of institutions so let me back up. 27.18 was provisions. excuse me, it was 27.14. There are provisions that were added last session that include the advisor reporting or responding party to provide opening and closing remarks. Institutions were concerned about this and thinking that it would set the stage incorrectly more to a courtroom procedure, so they thought that that provision, they were strongly recommended across the board to remove that. Mr. Chair.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're all confused because the line number was incorrect. I believe we're talking about Senate version 33.1. If you're talking about deleting out lines 33.1, 0.2, and 0.3, where it talks about that the advisor would have opening and closing remarks, I believe that's where we are. Is that correct?
Chair Rogelmont and Chair Rarick, yes, that is what I'm talking about.
Thank you.
Okay, anything else, Chair Rarick?
No, just that we were just, I think she had said something about page 27, and we're actually on page 33, line 1, line 2, and line 3. So we're all just kind of paging through, like, where were we? So thank you, Mr.
All right, well, thank you for that, Chair Rarick. Please continue.
One provision on beginning on R36, the bottom on the Senate side, 3310.10, a provision on supportive measures for both an opportunity for supportive measures for both the reporting and responding party. And I believe that is not part of the House side. So again, feedback from the institutions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give us an example of what supportive measures might be?
Chair Rogelmont.
Ms. Watchke.
Chair Rarick, yes. Supportive measures can range from a change in residence to course changes to extensions on assignments during, you know, that going through the process, a grievance process may require some leniency on assignment extensions or absence, course absences.
Yeah. Anything further, Chair Rarick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are these intended to be more of a separation from victim and the offender, or as you said, change in residence or change in courses, like maybe they took classes together, or are you talking about that it's more of trauma-informed care where they have, you know, maybe the incident happened in their dorm room and so they prefer not to be in that dorm room? Like, what exactly do you mean by change in residence or change in courses?
Ms. Watchke.
Chair Wilgamont and Chair Rarick, actually it would mean both. It could be something in which the trauma-informed practice upon request, a victim, survivor, or complainant in the grievance process may request only a supportive measure, so therefore that would be the resolution. And it also could be to allow them the access to their education and benefit of the education.
Chair Rarick. Okay, further member questions. I recognize Chair Fateh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Watchke. And I just want a clarification. This language is in both the House and Senate position, right? It's just different locations.
Ms. Watchke.
Chair Wilgamont and Senator Fateh, I believe as I have looked at these, the House version does not include the supportive measures. So that is only in the Senate version on line 33.10 on R36.
Okay, and I think we can have our House research analysis provide further information to your question. Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, members, so just for reference, the House bill on R36 at line 27.4 to 27.7 does contain a requirement that institutions have to offer academic and residential supportive measures as needed. So you can see sort of similar language to the Senate language at 27.4 to 27.7 on the House side.
Senator Frate. All right, any other member questions? Anything further, Ms. Watchke?
I think, Chair Rogelmont, thank you. I think it would be best to, instead of going through all of this, is just to talk a little bit about some of the opportunities and concerns that institutions voiced. So generally speaking, this process offers consistency and stability in a grievance process across institutions. In the Senate version, let's see if I can get this straight here. Trying to find the version or the actual line. In the Senate version on R37, line 33.19, a post-secondary institution must hold a hearing related to disciplinary action under this section if requested by the reporting or responding party. Many of the smaller institutions were concerned about this provision with the undue financial hardship that it could cause, as well as the administrative costs, the privacy concerns that very small institutions of 150 students or less may that it may compromise their privacy. On the Senate version, line 35.13.
Pardon me, Chair Fateh has a question. Chair Fateh.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you, Chair Wagenbach. I just wanted to clarify, in lines 33.19 and 33.20, that was language that was actually adopted in the Senate Judiciary Committee and language that was needed to help move along the bill. So I just wanted to let folks know that. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Rarick, are you seeking recognition? Okay, Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of along those lines, as I was reading this before, something kind of jumped out at me, and it's in the definitions. We have most of the definitions are direct either federal or state statute. So if you look at 32.7, it's a definition of sexual assault, and then it continues on K and L and M with statutory definitions. But my concern is just above that at 32.1, you have retaliation, which does not have a statutory definition. We've created a new definition. And my question is, where did that definition come from? Was that something that it came through judiciary? There's another section also that on the next page at 32.13, paragraph N, sexual misconduct. Again, that is a broad definition that does not have a statutory definitions. And you can see the difference because stalking below that, which is interesting because I helped write that definition, is a statutory definition. So my question is, those two chunks of statute that were proposing, retaliation definition and sexual misconduct definition, where did that come from? Where did that language come from? And what is the purpose of it?
Okay, I think I will recognize our Senate counsel, Ms. Birch. Oh, sorry, Mr. Watson.
I'm sorry, the question is where the definition for retaliation.
Let me repeat it.
Chair Rarick, please clarify the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question is, there in the definitions, most of them have got statutory references, but either state or federal, but there are a couple that do not. One being on line 32.1, so 32.1 retaliation, and then on the next page, the definition for sexual misconduct, and those are very broad definitions now.
Mr. Watson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the definition for, and to be clear, the only definition that's being added here is retaliation, and I believe that language originated with the OHE governor's bill. I might be wrong about that, but I think it came from OHI at some point. And then the sexual misconduct definition is in current statute.
Chair Rearick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so there was a choice then made to, instead of just reference it, just like stalking below that, like it says stalking has the meaning given in section 609.749. Why was it chosen, why was the choice made to write it, or, you know, write it all out as opposed to just do a statutory reference, as in all the other sections of that section?
Mr. Watson, if you'd care to comment, otherwise we can ask someone from OHI to provide a response.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't speak to where the one in current statute came from because I wasn't here, so maybe OHI would be the...
All right. Ms. Watchke or anyone else from the OHI team, please give us an answer to Chair Rearick's question.
Chair Wogelmont and Chair Rearick, the definition of retaliation came from the federal definition in Title IX. It was based on that definition.
All right. Anything further, Chair Rearick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if you could, you don't have it off the top of your head, I'm sure. That would be really unfair. But if you could send that to us and let me know what that federal definition is, because if it's not exactly the same, I'd like to see what the differences are. And also, if you happen to know, what is the statutory definition citation for sexual misconduct? Because this is, to me, it looks like it's fairly new because it includes something like deep fake depicting intimate parts and so on, which is something that is a fairly new conversation here at the legislature. So if either nonpartisan Senate counsel or if OHI could provide me with the statutory reference for that definition. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Ms. Watchke, anything further? Oh, Chair Fateh.
Thank you. And I had a question from Ms. Watchke. On the House language 27.22 through 27.24, does it require the institutions to have a live hearing, or does it give them the choice or option to do so?
Ms. Watchke.
I'm sorry. Chair Wogelmont and Senator Fateh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear what you were asking.
No worries.
Chair Fateh, if you'd repeat the question.
Thank you. Yes, on lines 27.22, 23, and 24 on the House language, does that language require the institutions to have a live hearing, or does it give them the option or the choice to do so?
Ms. Watchke.
Chair Wogelmont and Senator Fateh, I believe the intent of this was to with the or on underlined is to allow both. So both the live hearing or a questioning by a decision maker. So the flexibility.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so reading that definition there in 27, 22 through 24, maybe it's for House Counsel, but it says through a live hearing or questioning by decision maker. How is decision maker defined? Who is that person?
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, that would be someone that would be appointed by the institution to resolve the investigation. So if you look at the House language at 27.14, so it says if an institution conducts a hearing. So under the House language, there's an ability for an institution to conduct a hearing, but there's not a requirement that there has to be a live hearing necessarily. So another option besides a live hearing could be resolution through a decision maker, or this could be questions at the live hearing can be conducted either by the advocates or representatives of the parties or by the decision maker. So it's sort of pseudo-judicial role, like the judge asking questions to analogize it to a trial, as opposed to the lawyers for the parties.
Thank you.
Representative Robbins.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I appreciate that. I do think perhaps we should tighten that up as we move forward, because decision maker is not that clear. And I think the definition Mr. Hopkins referred to earlier about the party's advisor maybe specifying that they can test the credibility of the party and witnesses through a live hearing or questioning by the institutional arbitrator, or whatever that word will be, or the party's advisors, because I think the party's advisors should play a role in that.
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, also on the House line, on the House language at R37, if you look at 27.29, that paragraph I, so that creates a requirement for the institution to appoint decision makers or panels of decision makers for purposes of a live hearing.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. That does help. So maybe just saying it earlier, I don't know. It seems like if it's coming after where that section is, it's a little confusing, but thank you.
All right. Any other member questions at the moment? Okay. Anything further, Ms. Watchke?
Chair Wolgamont and members, committee members, one of the lines that I mentioned earlier on the Senate version 35.13 to 35.155, and let's see what number that is. It is on page R39. There is a concern of the language that it says on 35.14, a post-secondary institution must apply at a minimum preponderance of the evidence standard of proof. The concern is to what end? Could there be a beyond a reasonable doubt? Because there's not a cap as well, and that would enter into more of a criminal court proceeding rather than a campus resolution. So kind of preponderance of the evidence, as I've testified before, I believe in the Senate, is the most common across the nation to use. Clear and convincing is also used at times. When I surveyed the 77 institutions, all but one used preponderance of the evidence standard. So clear and convincing is kind of the second one that is used and currently allowed by Title IX. But preponderance of the evidence is by far the most used standard.
Recognize Chair Fate.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamont, and thank you for that. And again, I just wanted to mention for this section 35.13 through 15 that this is also language that was added in the Judiciary Committee as well.
Thank you. Okay, Ms. Watchke, anything further?
I do not believe so.
Okay, do we have any other member questions? Okay, well, thank you very much for your testimony. Members, next up to testify is Patty Kirsten, the Vice President of Student Affairs and Title IX Coordinator at Hamline. We also will be joined by Mr. Carl Crosby Lehman, the Vice President and General Counsel at St. Olaf. All right, welcome to the conference committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Hello, everyone. I'm Patty Kirsten. I'm the Vice President for Student Affairs, Dean of Students, and Title IX Coordinator at Hamline University. I've been at Hamline for about 20 years and have fulfilled this Title IX role for about 12 years.
And good afternoon. I'm Carl Crosby Lehman. I'm the General Counsel from St. Olaf College. I also work with an entity called Ballast, and we provide Title IX services to other institutions around the state.
So I think, thank you, Chairman. I think where we wanted to start was really being able to talk about the Title IX process, our sexual misconduct process in a smaller college. When you think about a campus of about 1,600, every student knows each other, faculty and staff know each other. It's a community that we've created. And so one of the things when we talk about requiring a campus hearing for instances of sexual misconduct, if every incident were to have to go through a hearing and that be a mandated requirement, it really creates a chilling effect on our campus. For someone to be able to come forward to seek assistance, to be able to seek the supportive measures that are needed, to be able to make those kinds of decisions, it's really important to allow for, in our opinions or in my opinion, that the options for resolution in regards to cases to support all members of our community in having the full rights and processes, and also that ability to make those decisions, and for the campus to make the decision in regards to what process works best.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I appreciate the concern about cost that was referenced earlier. That's certainly something that's important to us, but far more important to us is, as Ms. Kirsten mentioned, the chilling effect that it has on reporting. And this is empirical. As many of you know, the requirement to have hearings has been in place because of federal regulation since 2020. There was a brief period of time when the last administration's regulations went into effect in the summer of 2024, but that was quickly overturned when the new administration took over. So basically from 2020 until now, we have had the requirement that we have hearings on campus. At our institution, in the 4 years prior to 2020, we had 39 cases go through our grievance process. After that, since 2020, when we've been required to have hearings, we've had 10. And I know from working with institutions across the state that this is consistent. Many have not had any hearings at all in the last 4 years, and of those that have, I think St. Olaf would stand out as one of the rare cases that we've had as many as we've had.
All right, are there any member questions, member discussion? Chair Fateh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for coming to testify. I guess my question is, does the current language allow the reporting party to determine if an investigation takes place? So can they report and not have the choice to not have an investigation happen?
Mr. Lehman.
Yes, in fact, that's the vast majority of the cases we see. Most individuals who come forward to report to us that they've been a victim of sexual assault, they'll say things like, I don't want to ruin this person's life. I don't want to have to go through the process at all. All I want are these supportive measures that were mentioned earlier. So the majority of our cases are just providing support measures. Of the ones that are left, the majority of those cases are resolved on our campus through what we call our informal resolution process. That's a process where a trained facilitator works with both parties individually. They don't meet together. They meet separately to try and identify what is it that you would want and need in order to feel comfortable moving forward. And that's a process that has worked well on our campus at resolving most of these. And then of the few that remain, those go through our grievance process.
Okay, great. Further member discussion. I recognize Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And sorry, I just wanted to clarify something. You said for the previous 4 years there were 39, and was that hearings that you said there were 39, and then that number went down to 10?
So we're a campus that has heard loud and clear from our community that they don't want hearings. They want this resolved through a different process. On our campus, what we do is we have an investigator investigate, prepare a report, and then right now we have a hearing process because we're required to under federal regulation. But prior to 2020, we had an investigator, provided a report, and then an adjudicator. I think at that time we had three people from our campus that adjudicated the matter. And they could go back and ask questions. They could get further information, but they're the ones that decided ultimately whether or not they felt the accused student was responsible. And I should just say, under that process, it came out pretty much 50-50. Half of the time we found respondents not responsible, and half the time we found them responsible. And under our hearing process, we're seeing the same results. So I would argue that we can provide due process. We should provide due process, whatever process we use. But you don't need a hearing in order to make sure that it's a fair process, that people's rights are respected.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And sorry, I think I may have been a little bit unclear with my question. I just couldn't. You said there were 39. Something. I just couldn't remember what you said.
So those were 39 cases where the person who brought their concern forward to us said, I want the college to investigate this and take action.
Okay.
We did not use a hearing in those 39. We used the hearing in those 10 after 2020.
I was just a little confused. I wanted to make sure I understood that process better. I guess, I think that's all. I just wanted to make sure I understood what you were saying. Thank you.
All right. Further member discussion. I recognize Vice Chair Putnam.
So just a point of clarification following up on Representative Coulter's point. Is that 39 in 1 year?
No, that was Mr. over Raymond. A four-year period prior to, 4 year period prior, just prior to 2020.
Senator Putnam.
Thank you for that answer. I'm wondering about the moment wherein you, sort of before the four-year period, are you noticing trends in frequency? Or are your reporting efforts just getting to be a little bit more efficient?
Great
Mr.
question.
Mr. Lehman.
Thank you. Sorry I jump on these. I'll wait to be called, Mr. Chair. Sorry about that.
No worries.
So we have to report annually under state law on the number of cases that are reported. And during that four-year period, we had 358 cases that we reported over that year. So again, most of those were people who didn't want to use our process. So you can see it dives down to only 40 went forward. But 350 in the 4 years prior to 2020, 312 in the 4 years after. And I would argue it's pretty close, but I would argue the dip is because victims did not want to come forward knowing that they'd have to go through a process where they'd be cross-examined by a lawyer representing the person who they're accusing of assaulting them.
Anything further, Senator Putnam? All right. Any other member questions? Representative Rarick.
Thank you. Thank you for being here today. I'm just wondering, since there's quite a bit of language already in federal statutes, the proposed language in either the House or the Senate, is that something that you feel is needed? It sounds like you're kind of doing all of these things independently, and I know you're just one school, but is this something that you need to clarify what you're already doing? Anything like that?
Ms. Kirsten.
Yes. In all honesty, I would say that when I think about all of the provisions that get put on at either a state level or at a federal level, the reality is, you know, we were doing these things prior.
you know, the idea of each student having due process, whether they're responding to allegations or whether they're coming forward. If it's about being able to support an individual in an academic setting who's gone through a really traumatic experience or being accused of creating a traumatic experience, that has impacts in all of the parties that are involved, in their friend groups, in those that are supporting those students and their families, et cetera. And I think we've worked to create due process throughout all of that. Being able to have the ability to create investigations, to be able to make sure that all parties can see those, that they can respond to those, and that we can get as much information as possible moving forward in a difficult situation. And then having the ability to have a trained decision maker or whatever the process the campus has. We used to have a different process than hearing when we were able to do that, where we would have a review committee go through and review all of the documents and then make a decision of was a policy violated or not. Those kinds of processes we were allowed, I think we were most supporting our students, putting people in a hearing where they have to be questioned on the spot to responding. Even my own nerves in this setting, when you're all very positive towards me, et cetera, the nerves come out and people don't always think to or are able to respond in what is their best self and the reactions of everything that has gone on. And so we really have felt like those other processes have really best met. And again, we've had all kinds of requirements that have been put on us from a federal level. Sometimes the state and federal are at odds with each other, and then it's about making decisions about which one are we following through.
Further member discussion, Chair Eric.
Thank you. Just really quickly, a follow-up to that. I appreciate you saying that. You had initially referenced your reporting requirements, and that's actually a bill that I'd worked on a decade ago so that there was transparency. But the one thing that I did religiously is talk to all the different institutions, all the way down to a taxidermy school that had four students, right? I mean, just the whole breadth of it. And then also made sure that we were not conflicting with federal law at that time. So I understand that, and I know how confusing and frustrating that can be. I've never worked harder on a bill with listening to all the different parties, everybody from the University of Minnesota and Minn State system all the way down to a taxidermy school with four students. So I hear you, and that was really the impetus of my question, because sometimes, you know, we lawmakers have good intentions and administration has good intentions, but I wanted to hear, you know, is this something that your two schools, your school, one school, right?
Two.
It is two. Yeah. Okay. I thought you said two different schools. That this would be a benefit to you. And somewhere along the line, somebody thought this would be a good idea, but I just wanted to hear it from the two schools that are here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, Mr. Lehman.
Thank you. I was going to just echo a little bit I think that if you look at the numbers that I've gave you, and those are St. Olaf's numbers, but they are pretty consistent in terms of the number of reports and the number of grievance process cases that we see. I think that cries out for it would be more impactful to have sexual assault prevention education on campus, to focus on schools making those services available, than it would be on the response. The response is important. As Ms. Kirsten said, I think we've got it, and we do it, and there we've always got the criminal law as a backstop to that too. These are crimes, and so there's other ways of getting justice for victims in these situations too.
All right, Senator Putnam.
Oh, I want to thank you both for your candor today. It's a difficult thing to talk about. And as Senator Duckworth knows, I work at a private school in the state, one that is notoriously dishonest about these issues and has a very difficult past when it comes to concerns like this. In fact, about 10 years ago, I had a colleague who was going to do some research into the precedence of sexual assault on campus, and he was told not to. And then when he asked for data, he was told that there had been two or three assaults in the past 10 years, which we all know is not true. And I say that to congratulate you and to thank you for the work that you're doing now, but also to underscore how important legislation like this is. because it requires people to be a little bit more thoughtful and open about something that's very difficult and challenging. And I have to say again, Senator Fatah and I just pulled Cora over to the side. My daughter goes to St. Olaf. She's a junior there now. And we're not good at math, but it doesn't sound good, like the odds of being there and at least not knowing someone who's been sexually assaulted seem like they're awfully high. So again, I just want to thank you for your work and underscore the importance of what we're doing right now.
Thank you, Senator Putnam. Further member discussion, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers for your discussion. I am relatively new to this topic, so perhaps this is a simple question, but we've been talking about the difference between the grievance process you have and a formal hearing. And someone, I don't remember who, said there was a cross-examination and lawyers. Could you just articulate to me what's the difference? Because I have heard from victims who honestly feel like without a hearing, they get pressured to the point one of you said, like, oh, don't ruin someone's life. Oh, don't report. Oh, don't. The victims who have reached out to me have felt pressure not to participate in the process. So I think that's one reason requiring a hearing is important, so that there's a relief for that pressure they get not to report or not to go through with the process. So could you just, A, tell me the difference between a grievance process and a formal hearing, and then B, how do you, have you talked to victims about what they think about hearings? Thank you.
Mr. Lehman.
Thank you. The grievance process is the term we use to cover all of the parts of the response when an individual says, I want to go forward with an investigation. So the grievance process involves initially an investigation, then an investigation report that they have some ability to review and comment on, and then it currently under the federal regulations, it would then have to move into a hearing where a trained hearing officer then meets with both parties. They're there together. The parties have a right through their advisors, and oftentimes students, you know, it's high stakes. It's completely understandable. They hire lawyers to represent them in these processes. And the lawyer, through their advisors, the parties get to cross-examine all of the witnesses, including the other party involved in the process.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. And is that an open process? Is everyone in the same room, or is that done separately?
Mr. Lehman.
It can be, but under the federal regulations, it has to be recorded. And we, if a party asks to be concealed, they can get that granted. And so I think most institutions just opt to use Zoom, as because it you can record it, people can turn their cameras off, and so it works easily just to have it in a virtual setting like that.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. That's helpful. So in your discussions of this, have you heard from victims that they don't want to go through that extra hearing process? Can you speak to the numbers or why? Because honestly, the victims who I've spoken to feel like they get pressure not to report or not to go through this.
Ms. Kirsten.
Yeah, first I'd like to say in regards to reporting, our campuses should be creating environments where everyone can report incidences of any kind of sexual misconduct. And that should be, that needs to be a part of what it is that we are all about, to be able to know where our numbers are, know what issues we have and where those are, to be able to respond to. I think that's really, really important. But in that reporting and coming forward and saying this happened, the idea of I'm going to have to go through a hearing in the end where whether or not I want to see or hear that other person, I know that other person's going to be there and I'm going to have to respond to their attorney or their advisor's questions after I've already gone through a full investigation where I've told you everything and I've had to be asked multiple times to respond in ways to be able to answer all of the questions. The hearing itself, in my experience, when an investigation has been done the right way, provides no additional information at all. Everything is there already in writing because we've asked every question that can come up through the parties. You know, tell us, respondent, what other questions do you have? Tell us, complainant, what other questions you have. And we've asked those ahead of time without the pressure of the other person listening or without an attorney ready to jump on whatever the response is. And so that hearing hasn't done more. And for students that have had to go through that process afterwards, I've heard from students with, I might just as well have gone to court because it felt exactly the same. I thought my university would take care of me and support me through this. And although we do our best in that, coming out of those hearings and sitting through those hearings, I can say I've heard the same response from respondents and complainants regardless of what the final decision is. It isn't a supportive environment for any of the parties, regardless of what the outcome is.
Any further member discussions or questions? All right. Well, thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on these provisions? Are there any other member questions or discussions before we adjourn? Seeing no further discussion and there being no further business before this committee, we are adjourned.